Hello and welcome back to the Dune Minute Podcast, your place to dive deep minute by minute into the cinematic adaptation of Frank Herbert's World of Dune. I am one of your hosts, Zach.
And I'm John.
And we are back on this lovely Tuesday episode for the listening audience. Still Sunday for us, mere minutes from the last record.
It's about 10.
About 10 minutes. We had a nice little Lego slash Dune photography slash Michael Shannon talk.
The crux of the Michael Shannon talk was he would have been a very weird but very interesting Shaddam Fourth.
I completely agree. That would have been a really cool casting. The reason Shaddam gets brought up, we'll find out later in this minute. We are, of course, talking about minute 126 through 127 of Dune Part 2 by Denis Villeneuve.
Yep.
And as expected, we pick up right where we left off.
No way.
That is how this show works.
Holy shit.
I know. If you expect us to fast forward 15 minutes, you are wrong.
I'm glad I was sitting down for that news. Yes, Chani is still very, very pissed. We continue with more Lisan al-Gaibing.
Lots of fist pumps.
It's a 2002 rave all over again. And we get that for about three more seconds before we cut over to a new scene and we see a close-up shot of the ducal signet as it then turns towards another, for the first time in this movie, melted wax pool.
Yeah.
But this time it's on the side of like a metal rod.
It's like a long silver tube of some sort.
Yeah. We see the ducal signet impress the Atreides eagle into this wax. And I don't know if you noticed, because I did.
Okay.
The side of the ducal signet, there's a nice little emerald that's, you know, cut into the side of the ring. And then there's across the outer edge of the circular part of the signet, there's galak that's carved into it. And everything. Cool. So a lot of detail into this ring. You know how movies, or you know how actors will bring home like a souvenir or whatever?
I was just about to ask you something related to this.
Do you think Oscar Isaac took a signet home with him?
I don't know.
I would like to ask like each of the actors, like, did you bring anything from set home with you? And like, what was it?
Yeah.
Because I feel like if I was Oscar Isaac in this moment, like, I would want to bring home one of the signets.
That would be a fantastic, fantastic prop to take home with you.
Yeah.
The question I was going to ask was, what would you take home with you? That's not a glow globe. I already know that you take a glow globe.
Damn it.
I already know that.
Because we talked about this already.
I know.
If I had anything that's not a glow globe that I could take home with me from Dune, part one or part two?
Give me one for each.
My part one would be the box.
Yeah, that's fun.
Part two, I mean, if it couldn't be a glow globe, it would have to be the box and the thumper.
Okay, those are good choices.
Yeah.
I think for me, for part one, I'd have to go with a glow globe.
Motherfucker, you just said... this bitch.
Since it wasn't already taken, I'll have to go with the glow globe.
Ooh.
No, for part one, I think the box is a great choice.
Or the Gamja bar.
Ah, yeah, okay. We could have another custody battle for box and slash or box slash Gamja bar.
Yeah.
I really like the bullfighting figurine that's on the table. That's really cool. Yeah. I would like that. That does also kind of fit with my overall aesthetic that I have in my home.
It does.
So I think that would be the thing I take.
You could put the box in one of your bookshelves.
Yeah. Yeah.
Just be like, what's that? Pain.
For part two, I think I'm gonna have to go with that weird little musical instrument that the Harkonnen lady was playing.
Oh yeah,
provided that it worked. you know?
I don't think it did.
No, I know, but I would want it to work.
Oh, okay. Yeah, okay. Those are your conditions.
Yeah, this is a fanciful conversation.
Sure.
The box doesn't actually work too, so. But that would be cool if it did. No, yeah, that little, that weird musical instrument. You know how I like to collect musical instruments?
So yeah.
That would be a cool thing to take.
I would want one of the gloves, the weird, like, finger condom gloves that the attendants have.
Or maybe the raincoats where all those raincoats got murked up a while back.
Actually,
that's a nice raincoat.
I would want something that could realistically take home, which is one of the tuxedo t-shirts, still suit t-shirts that we talked about last week.
Well, we have a whole wish list.
Yeah. And it'll never happen.
No. So after we see this long silver tube and the seal gets, or the signet gets imprinted in the wax, we do a hard cut.
And our hard cut is not only a visual hard cut, but it's a musical hard cut too. Because like during the like rising of the Lisan al-Ghaib and like all that up to the wax being impressed with the eagle seal, we've got like big horns blaring everything, and then it's just silence.
Just the reverb, basically,
yeah,
cutting out. And we get to see Shaddam Karina, the Padishah Emperor. Shaddam the Fourth, thank you.
Yeah.
In his pinstripe muumuu. It looks very comfortable. And he's
looking very breathable.
Yeah, he looks a little rough for wear.
Yeah. He's looked rough for wear throughout all the times that we've seen him in this movie.
Very true. This has been the first time we've seen him in a hot minute in this movie. Since like the early
since parts. Before the whole conversation between Gaius Hellenmoheim and Irulan about what if Paul Atreides were still alive, and then also like, hey, by the way, there's this guy named Fade Rotha who's a fucking freak.
Right. So was that like almost an hour ago in the movie?
About.
Yeah.
Maybe even more.
Oof. All right. Well,
yeah.
It's been a minute.
Yep.
Been a few since we've seen Shaddam. And he's standing in a courtyard type area. I counted 5 Sardaukar guards in the background. This is clearly the palace on Khitan. And I'm assuming shot in the same place in Italy.
Nope.
No. Okay. Nope. Cool. Well, hold that then. I want to hear where this was shot.
Yep.
In the background, we see effigies carved into the walls of various battles. The marble, I'm assuming it's marble, looks really weathered in the background. And like we see weeds that are growing up in between the cracks of the floor here. And like piles of leaves in the corners. Like, so this
it's
is
a not, very unkempt garden.
Right. It's not very imperial palace as we have come to know it. It's very different. So I think this is meant to portray decay.
Yeah. And that's one of the things that, you know, Denis had always talked about with his choosing of his casting as Christopher Walken for the Emperor Shaddam, is that he wanted to show that Shaddam's grip on everything is crumbling. He's a weak and feeble man at this point. He is incapable of continuing to lead. Yeah. And I also noticed, you know, the state of disarray of this courtyard and everything. And, you know, that is very much a moment of show, don't tell.
Sure.
And as we've talked about many times, love that shit. But Shaddam still clearly has, you know, the respect and reverence of a bunch of people around him because people like to suck up. And we see in front of Shaddam a servant completely like kneeled with his head down and his hands up, holding a cloth. And then atop the cloth is this silver tube.
Yeah.
And you know, Shaddam reaches down and takes it, kind of tilts it on the side, looks at that seal again. And we see the Atreides eagle, and he slowly opens it up to just beautifully carved Galak on this, you know, silver scroll.
Yeah.
And he kind of like twists it in his hand, reads it for a moment.
Well, before we move on,
Yeah.
I want to talk about the message cylinder.
Yeah.
Which is what this is.
Mm-hmm.
It's something that is mentioned a few times in the books. Now this...
What we talked about it last week. Because when we were talking about...
Did I forget all of last week?
No, because I kind of teased that we were going to be talking about it this week.
God, I thought I was just like missing a section of what we talked about from my memory.
No, so when we were talking about the slow down moment that Jessica has,
mm-hmm.
we were talking about how in the book, there's much more like internal... Not monologuing, but just kind of describing what Jessica is thinking in this moment sure. as it's happening. And one of the things that is brought up is what was the message true to what was in the cylinder or something to
right,
that extent.
Right.
And this is the cylinder that we were talking about last week.
Gotcha. Okay. Now, messenger cylinders are simple analog message storage devices designed with discretion in mind to prevent easy espionage. Just so I'm reading off the Dune Wiki right now. Shout out to the editors of the Dune Wiki. They are, as the name implies, metal cylinders with a message tape inside. Now, the departure that we get from established like book canon to these is that the messages are typically inscribed on some kind of film, specifically magnetic film.
Yep.
And it's the wiki describes it as a byproduct of shiga wire, which is usually meant to like cut people's throats, but it's like a really really fine fiber that's found in the Dune universe.
Yeah, well, we've seen shiga wire on multiple occasions, mm-hmm. both in this movie but then also in Prophecy.
Yeah, so. Exactly. So it's that same, or it's derived from the same material. Usually they say it's 1 micron in diameter, which is crazy.
God damn.
Crazy thin.
Yep.
But it is for like once it's exposed to air and, you know, and presumably red, it will start to decay. If we transport back to the beginnings of the Atreides, I guess, dominion in Arrakis, one of the things that Thufir Hawat mentions is that they found a spy and he had on him a message cylinder that had already decayed most of the way.
Yeah.
But they were able to intercept and stop the decay, and they were able to figure out some of the plans of the Harkonnens, like the Harkonnen spies that remained on Arrakis. So these message cylinders, they do play an important part in the story whenever we need them.
Very conveniently.
Yeah. Yeah.
I like the way that the message cylinder is portrayed in this movie way more than I think I would if they had tried to do it in like a here's a tape and it's going to start decaying kind of way.
It would have been very Mission Impossible had it just been like a decayed tape yeah. kind of thing. Yeah, no, I agree. It fits the purpose here better. My confusion is how do you know where to start reading this thing?
Well, it probably helped to know like the language and how to read it.
Sure.
So maybe there's a little bit of that.
Yeah. Because it looks like the whole thing, like 360 degrees around, is just full of text.
Yeah.
And Shaddam actually doesn't open it up all the way.
I don't think it fully comes out.
No?
No.
Because it looked like Irulan, and spoilers, it looked like Irulan opened it up a lot further than he did. No?
Nope.
Okay.
Nope. So yeah, I mean, let's just get into it now. So Shaddam takes it, starts spinning it, reading it. And then the camera kind of does the thing where it just kind of like pans over to the side and we see Irulan mm-hmm. behind him.
Yeah.
She's got this very fancy beaded headpiece on and everything.
Yep.
Unlike other Dune movies and other Dune TV properties, though, it's not like big and up top. It's just very like tight to her head.
Yeah.
A
full head covering. I mean, yeah, leaving her face exposed, but full head covering outside
yes.
of that.
And all the attendants behind are in their own garb, which I will get to later. But then we cut to a near the ground level shot from behind Shaddam. We see the message cylinder just fall to the ground, and he just like slowly stumbles away. Ulan immediately rushes to pick up the message cylinder, not to console her father, but to read for herself.
Yeah.
And she looks down, reads it, looks back up at Shaddam, yep. and he's continuing to walk away.
And we get a nice little J cut here.
Well, love these. Well, hold on. I have a couple things.
Okay. Okay.
First of all, this was not shot at the Brion Sanctuary in Italy. This was shot in Budapest at the Fiume Road Cemetery.
Mm.
Probably pronounced that horribly wrong. F-I-U-M-E-I.
Okay.
Fiume Road Cemetery in Budapest. The larger blocks that we see behind Shaddam in the start of the scene are actually a part of all of this. Oh, really? It is a old Soviet memorial.
Interesting.
Which is why it looks so like
dilapidated
and utilitarian and yeah. just like hard angles everywhere.
Brutalist.
Right. It's concrete. So, you know, you said that it looked like weathered marble. Nope. It's just straight concrete because Soviet.
Fuck yeah. Concrete.
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 The only thing that was really added here was behind Shaddam in the very opening scene, we see a giant statue of three Sardaukar warriors.
Right.
That was added, but the giant like blocks are a part of the actual memorial and everything.
And the carvings in them, are those also?
It's all Soviet art.
Interesting.
Yeah.
Well, they did a very good job of making this blend like seamlessly
together.
Also
can't really see too well what it is.
No, but so you said the statue was added.
Yeah.
The statues looks like the same kind of art style as the carvings on the wall. So
sure.
They did a good job of making this all feel continuous.
Yeah.
When I was looking at that statue of the three people, I just started to wonder. I mean, we don't get any kind of indication of what this is memorializing.
I mean, it would be Sardaukar because you can see that one of them is wearing a Sardaukar helmet. They all have Sardaukar swords and everything like that. But we don't have... Yeah, it doesn't say, here's Bob, Joe, and Steve, the three best Sardaukar that ever lived, or whatever.
Oh, man. Bob, Joe, and Steve deserve a statue like this. Yeah, that's really cool. I mean, major kudos to the art department
mm-hmm.
for making this just fit so seamlessly together. Fooled me.
Now, before we continue on with the remaining parts of this minute, which there's not a lot, but no. there is some components of this minute left. I have beeves.
Okay.
So we see, like we just talked about a few moments ago, Irulan and other members of the Imperial Court behind her.
Mm-hmm.
I hate so much the downgrade in the quality of the Imperial Court's attire
sure.
from part one to part two. We saw them in part sure. one during the Herald of the Change ceremony.
Harold came to visit, yeah.
Yep. They were all in various shades of maroons and whites and blacks and grays.
Mm-hmm.
Here they are all in just gray with like these big high fashion, like loopy pieces in their like attire and everything.
Sure.
Whereas in part one, it was way more Daft Punk, way more like futuristic looking.
Sure.
And just sure. weird and out there.
Okay. I agree with you. And I'm going to offer a headcanon explanation. Ceremonial versus casual.
I don't like that.
That is a thing, though.
But
because that the Herald of the Change was a big fucking ceremony.
Sure, but you had color and like kind of like a little bit of life to all of the attire that was being worn earlier. To now, everyone just wears gray and it's boring and it sucks.
Okay, well, if we're gonna tie this into things that we've talked about before. Mere minutes ago in this episode, the whole thing is meant to portray decay.
Sure.
And a lowering of pomp and circumstance and just a lowering of the position.
Yeah, I mean, I get that. It's just...
I agree that these costumes are worse.
Yeah. Okay. I'm glad that you also agree that these costumes are objectively worse.
Yeah, no, I agree with that, but I think it's done with reason.
Yeah. I don't like it.
So, we'll get back to that J cut I was talking about.
Yeah.
Nice little J cut. Now, for those unfamiliar, a J cut is where the audio of a following scene overlaps with the visuals of a preceding scene. So it's where we get to hear Irulan talk before we get to see what she's talking or who she's talking to.
Yeah.
So we get to hear her voice as she's looking very shocked and surprised at her father walking away from what she's just read. We get to hear what she just read. She goes, "Paul Atreides is still alive. He challenges my father." And halfway through this sentence, the scene changes over and we get to see a hand writing on some paper.
Yep.
And we cut to this veiled figure who we'll learn here in a second.
I mean, it's Guy's Helen Mohan.
Yeah, it's Guy's Helen Mohan.
We're not learning anything at this point. Well, we are 30 minutes left in this movie. We ain't learning shit. It's Moheim, because who else would be sitting at a desk writing anything as a Bene Gesserit in the Imperial Palace?
And she's got the thick veil on today.
She's got the thick veil with the bigger holes, but more importantly...
Well, hang on. She's at a small little desk. I'm holding this off as long as I can, John.
Fucker.
She's at a small little desk, skinny little thing.
Tiny, tiny desk.
It's got way too much stuff on it.
This is the most NPR tiny desk concert.
Big old chair, too.
Big old chair. And I don't know if you noticed on the table, she's got like little trinkets.
Oh, yeah. This desk is way too small.
One of which is a giant like glass for reading small text.
Mm-hmm.
She's old as fuck. So makes sense.
Now, let's talk about the background. And I'm talking about the walls.
You motherfucker. Fuck you. I'm taking over. There's a motherfucking glow globe in
the
background.
We get a glow globe!
We get a Bene Gesserit glow globe because this glow globe is also wearing a veil.
Hey, we love consistency. Is it really?
It's wearing a veil, awesome. Yeah. So on top of it, it's got the same like kind of covering with like all the little holes and stuff in it.
Amazing.
Yeah.
Amazing.
So we've seen now an Atreides standard glow globe.
Mm-hmm.
We've seen an Atreides pocket glow globe. We've seen the Harkonnen glow globe, which was very different, very more like brutalist and clunky, as most Harkonnen devices are. And now we've seen a Bene Gesserit glow globe.
I love it. This is great.
10 out of 10.
And truth be told, I almost missed it. No, I know you did. I know you didn't. But it does kind of blend into the background a fair amount more than the glow globes we've seen in the past. But
how could you?
What a chef's kiss of a glow globe. Is this the last one we're going to see?
This is our last glow globe.
God damn it.
Yeah. I'm sorry.
Well... What a glow globe to go out on.
Yep.
A veiled glow globe. It just goes to show that no matter what faction, no matter what their owner's predilections are.
Yep.
The glow globes are the shining light in this dark, dark movie.
Figuratively and literally.
Yes, they are.
And... they're just out here doing their job.
Doing the work. Putting in the work.
They're clocking in and they're never clocking out.
What? Shout out to all the glow globes out there.
All that little bioluminescent bacteria just working hard.
The best part of this movie.
10 out of 10.
10 out of 10
for already, glow globes. Already for the week.
So Guy's Helen Mohan responds to Irulan's... sentence, "He challenges my father," and she doesn't exactly address what Irulan's saying.
She doesn't even like stop.
No,
she's still just like sitting there writing.
Right.
This almost as if this isn't even news to her, which
it isn't.
No. It's not. Because she's just so matter of fact, where she's just like, yeah, you've never been on Arrakis. It's quite impressive. You'll see.
Mm. And we get a shot of Irulan's face kind of close up. And we can really see the beadwork on this head covering. And now, this is not a knock on the costume department, because I think the costume department does awesome in everything they do in this movie.
Mm-hmm.
This looks very much like a modern thing.
What, the beadwork?
The beadwork, yeah. It is just standard beadwork that you could see on any prom dress in America. I mean, it's this is nothing futuristic necessarily about what we're seeing. It's beautiful. Mm-hmm. I'm not saying it's not beautiful. It is absolutely gorgeous, but it is standard beadwork. Elaborate, but standard beadwork.
Sure.
So it's nice to see that one of the crafts has persisted 30,000 years into the future.
If I may.
Okay.
This beadwork was all done by hand.
Oh, I'm sure.
Yeah. Over 10,000 beads on this hood.
It's beautiful.
They found a local seamstress and she did it all. It's fucking insane.
I hope that Florence Pugh took home some of this stuff.
I would be curious what she would bring home with her.
Yeah.
Because
it's got to be fitted. It's not like they can reuse this. Yeah, I'd be interested to know what Florence Pugh brought home as well.
Yeah. I don't know.
So the minute ends with the close-up of Irulan's face. She says, we get most of her sentence, but not all of it.
I hate a mid-sentence cutoff.
Me too. Yeah, but it's got to happen sometimes. She says, was this all upon your... And that's where we end. Right there.
Your mama.
Yo mama.
I
got him. And guys, Helen Moham's like, I don't know my mama.
Maybe.
Maybe. I think she's got to have access. You know, she's got access. She's a full Reverend Mother. She knows
she's Mother Superior, I think.
Yeah, she knows. She knows.
Or at least it's implied, I would assume.
Not according to prophecy. The truthsayer to the Emperor is not necessarily the Mother Superior.
That's fair.
Because we had Kesha as the the truthsayer to the Emperor there. I know it's Kasha. All right, so that's where this minute ends. I have no book notes for today. I think you've sprinkled in your Art and Soul notes as we've gone on.
We got a motherfucking glow globe. That's all that matters to me.
We got a glow fucking globe.
Hell yeah. Let's come back tomorrow to finish this conversation up.
All right, let's do it.
In the meantime, you can find the Dune Minute online. We are on Blue Sky at DuneMinute.com, and you can email DuneMinute@gmail.com if you'd like to get in touch with us that way. We'll be back tomorrow for a Wednesday episode, and we'll see you then.
See ya.